I began filming once more. The first lot of men, or rather the remainder of them, had disappeared in the haze and smoke, punctured by bursting shells. What was happening in the German lines, I do not know. Other men were coming up and going over the top. The German machine gun fire was not quite so deadly now, but our men suffered badly from shell fire. On several occasions, I noticed men run and take temporary cover in the shell holes, but their ranks were being terribly thinned. These were the words that were written by the famous cameraman, Geoffrey Malins, and he was watching British soldiers go over the top and across no man's land towards Beaumont Hamel, towards the Hawthorne mine that had been blown a few minutes earlier. And this is a second podcast, a second episode of a podcast, looking at the story of how Malins and another man called McDowell filmed the build-up to the battle and the first few days of the battle itself, mainly the first day of the Battle of the Somme, the 1st of July 1916. If you haven't heard the first episode, please do go back and listen to that. But we're going to continue with our interview with Steve Roberts, who, together with Alistair Fraser and Andrew Robertshaw, wrote a book called Ghosts on the Somme, when they looked at how Malins and McDowell filmed the battle itself. And we look at some of the stories of the individuals that they managed to identify over a 2.5 year period. And Steve goes on to explain how they managed to identify some of the men that were captured in those famous images in and around the sunken lane. So let's get back to the interview and see what Steve has got to say as we look at some of the men that we see in the film that were making their way up towards the front line.
It's one of those Edmund Dawson then?
Yeah, Captain Pongo Dawson.
Fascinated by this bloke. Yeah, there's some wonderful photos.
He is a brilliant individual, a character. Yeah. Who
Why is he called Pongo?
It just goes from his time in the army in India.
Right.
He's, so he's a regular soldier, pre-war India, very good at polo apparently.
Yeah.
But he had the nickname in India of Pongo Dawson. And it sort of stuck. But he's serving as a captain at this point. With what Malins has done is he's filmed a group of individuals fixing bayonets and then going forward up a communication trench towards the front line.
We can see King Street.
Yeah, King Street and Esau's Way.
Yeah.
So we can pinpoint the location exactly.
Yeah. There's a sign, isn't there?
There is a sign there.
Yeah.
So the location is pinpointed. Now, when you watch the sequence in the film, you will see certain individuals. You'll see a guy called Corporal Holland.
Yeah.
On the left-hand side of the film, fixes bayonets and disappears off Downwards. Up Esau's
yeah.
Way. You'll also see standing with rifle over shoulder, Company Sergeant Major Nelson,
yeah.
who is the C Company Sergeant Major,
yeah.
And he just stands supervising the bayonet fixing. Then they all go off out of sight.
Yeah.
At this point, there's an officer is in the sequence.
Yep, there he is.
Yep, this guy. Now, we've never actually been able to identify. We did think at some point that he was a guy called Shepherd.
Yeah.
But, unfortunately, we can't prove it.
Did you go and see the family? You went to see the family?
Not for Mr. Shepherd. There was another officer called Casey.
I remember you went to see a family,
yeah.
didn't you?
Oh, I did. That was in connection with a later sequence,
right.
which was James Holland.
Second Lieutenant Ernest Shepherd talking
yeah.
about it here.
But Mr. Yeah. Shepherd, we can't really identify because we couldn't get a really good image to do a facial comparison.
Right.
So we're not sure
right.
if it's him. We think it is, but we're not sure.
But you know this is definitely
yeah.
Dawson, though.
But at this point, as the film runs through, there's some editing done because Shepherd suddenly becomes Captain Dawson.
Oh, right.
And at that point, we've also jumped ahead chronologically because
yeah.
Dawson is now shepherding people forward.
Yeah, yeah, like he's doing in this
yeah.
photo. Yeah.
But he also then, more editing, Dawson suddenly is still there when the wounded start to come back.
But he had already been wounded himself. As soon as they go over the top.
Yeah.
7:30, so he could have been supervising.
So he couldn't have been supervising the wounded comeback.
This is a mystery,
so, which is game, we know this is shot the day before.
Yeah, yeah.
Likewise.
Otherwise he wouldn't be wounded.
Likewise, the same time that Dawson is shot,
yeah.
Sergeant Major Nelson is shot as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So he
can't
be there. So, again, it's knowing the individuals, identifying the individuals, finding out what happened to them
yeah.
that allows you to then look at the sequence of the film and the chronological order and say, well, actually, that's not right.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can then challenge.
Yeah, the date.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For example, I mean, you just turned a page there, and there's another sequence which is shown, and it's captioned something like Royal Engineers carrying equipment forward.
Yeah, from the engineer stores.
Yeah, from the engineer stores. Now, this is supposed to have happened after the attack and after the mine crater, the Hawthorne crater, has exploded.
Yeah.
There is a slight problem, because when you look closely at the footage of these men, you can see Corporal Holland, you can see the officer we believe to be Lieutenant Shepherd.
Well, they're already back.
And you can see Sergeant Major Nelson.
They're in an advanced dressing station.
These are, so these are not Royal Engineers. These are C Company, Lancashire Fusiliers, who have been told, pick up all that kit and carry it.
Carry it, the day before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, this is where George Ashurst comes back in.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he talks about this filming taking place and being given packets of cigarettes.
Yeah. To do it.
To do it.
That's their appearance payment. Fee.
Yeah. So, again, we've got all these images jumping forward.
Yeah. I mean, it's not taking anything away from the film, is it? At all.
No, not at all.
It's a fantastic film.
Not at all.
It's just proving.
But it's identifying the images and the sequence.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It's like your old job being a detective, isn't it?
Very much so.
So, as with the first episode, we leave the interview there to look a bit closer at who this man Dawson was. And his full name was Edmund Dawson. He was born in Southbourne in Hampshire in September 1889. He went to Sandhurst and he was gazetted to the 2nd Battalion of the Lancashire Fusiliers at Tidworth. And he went out to India in 1910 to serve with the 1st Battalion. He played rugby, squash and tennis. He was also a competent boxer and a horseman. He was home on leave in August 1914. He was posted to the 9th Battalion, a service battalion, volunteers, when they were formed in Bury. And he became the brigade machine gun officer in October. He was promoted to captain in 1915. He landed at Gallipoli on the 7th of August 1915. And he became temporary major commanding the 5th Lancashire Fusiliers. He was wounded in November. And when he recovered, he joined the 1st Battalion in France. Now, as we know, he was badly wounded at 7:30 a.m. And he spent several months in hospital before returning to France. And he commanded a company within the 9th Service Battalion. He was wounded yet again in an attack at Langemarck in August 1917, 16th of August, a famous date in the Third Battle of Ypres. And one of his contemporaries said about him, nothing much deterred Pongo, and he was out again in France in 1918. He remained in the army at the end of the war. He served in India again, and he commanded a regimental depot and finally becoming second in command of the 1st Battalion. He retired from the army in 1934 and he died suddenly in Oxford on New Year's Day 1964. And his obituary described him as an excellent regimental officer who took part wholeheartedly in all the activities of the battalions which he served with. Now, Steve talked about in the first episode the documentary that they were part of, and that was called The Battle of the Somme, The True Story. And Dawson's granddaughter, Anne, she was traced and she was able to see her grandfather on the film, not as an elderly gentleman that she remembered, but as a young officer in one of history's greatest battles. And if you watch the film, you'll see what she saw, Dawson watching the men of his company as they turn up King Street towards the front line.
Malins himself then, this is the crux of it, isn't it? In chapter 7 in your book, Malins himself... how does he actually get to the... there's you, look, in the book. How does he actually get into the sunken lane? Does he set the same route as the soldiers?
Well, of course, what's happened is that the sunken lane is effectively in no man's land.
Yes.
It's about 150 metres, 150 yards or so from the British front line. It has exchanged hands several times during the course of the last 6 months. The Germans have occupied it, we've occupied it, the Germans have occupied it, because it's quite a dominant...
Yeah.
A feature in the landscape. But for the attack on the 1st of July, the plan has been that we will dig what's known as a Russian sap, very shallow trench, very shallow tunnel, which has been dug forward from the front line, the British front line, to the sunken lane. It's got a surface area above the top of the tunnel of about a foot to 18 inches. And the idea is that on the day, the Royal Engineers will break open the end of the tunnel into the lane, and two companies, B&D companies of the Lancashire Fusiliers will go through, line up in the lane, together with...
So not C Company then?
Not C Company. No. C Company are going to start from the front line.
Yeah.
Together with A Company.
Yeah.
They'll also take with them a section of trench mortars
yeah.
from the Brigade Trench Mortar Battery. And the idea is that they're halfway across no man's land.
Yes. Yeah.
So they've gained an advantage, yeah. and the minute that the attack starts, they've got half the distance to go.
Yeah, that's good in theory.
That's the plan. And the mortar men will provide rapid fire covering fire as they go.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Malins gets permission to go through the tunnel with his camera at 6:30 in the morning, together with the two companies.
But then we go back to what we said at the start of this podcast. He's got to carry all this big... Yeah. It's not like a little camera that we use on our mobile phones. No. He's got a great big camera.
Yeah. I would imagine, I don't know, and we'll never know because he doesn't actually mention it. I would imagine he's already got the camera fitted onto the tripod and he literally drags it. It could have done quite easily.
And he's got a spare film.
He's got to carry rolls of film.
Yeah.
And of course, once he's into the lane, what he then does is he sets up his tripod.
Yeah.
Again, he's got to be careful. He's got to make sure that he's not visible.
Well, otherwise he'll give the game away.
To the Germans because... Yeah. Exactly that.
Yeah.
So he then films a sequence of movie film, both up and down the lane.
Yeah. So is he in the middle then?
Roughly in the middle. You can actually see the depression where the tunnel comes out in the
lane
today.
Is he on the side of the lane where the exit to the tunnel is?
No, he's on the other side. He's as near to the other side as he can get without going into the troops themselves.
Right, yes, that's where they are.
He's as far across as he can get.
Yeah.
If he's on the tunnel side, then he's going to be quite visible, especially standing there.
Yeah. This is why the soldiers weren't there.
Yeah. What he then does is he films the two companies. Yeah. He then takes his camera, goes back through the tunnel, and has intended originally to set his camera up at a place called Jacob's Ladder, which is a part of the forward frontline trench system.
Yeah.
When he arrives at that spot, he finds that it's been damaged by German shell fire.
Yeah.
No longer suitable, can't put the camera there, too exposed, so he moves slightly further back.
Yeah.
And then re-establishes, sets up his camera in time to then film the mine explosion.
But before he does that, before he leaves the lane, this is where your lip readers have come in.
Yeah.
You've actually worked out what these soldiers are saying.
What some of them are saying, yeah.
Give us an example.
Well, certainly there's one individual... he's facing the camera. He's actually talking to, again, a young officer. The guy that he's talking to is a second lieutenant. You can clearly see his pip on his shoulder.
Yeah.
We don't know who he is because he never turns towards the camera.
No.
But the young man looks at him and says words to the effect, we're never going to get it 100%, but our forensic lip reader...
Got a dialect as well.
Yeah. Says that he turns to this guy and says, well, hope we're in the right bloody place this time. If not, I'm going to chuck all my bombs and bugger off.
So that tells us he's been in this situation before, in Gallipoli.
So he's a Gallipoli veteran.
Yeah.
But it's also interesting in that the forensic lip reader was able to watch the guy, looked at the way he formed his words, and was actually able to tell us that he was speaking with a northern dialect.
So we knew he was probably...
No idea whatsoever where these guys were from.
Wonder what happened to him. So you hadn't briefed her then?
No, she had no idea. I mean, there was a little clip later on in the film where there's a sequence of Germans... who are all coming towards the camera.
Yeah.
And she had no idea they were Germans.
Really?
But somebody out of shot was asking them a question and they're all saying nine.
And she's picked up on that.
German for no.
Yeah,
but she had no knowledge that they were Germans.
Yeah.
And she was really confused as to why all these men were saying nine.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because she didn't
know. Until we told her they're Germans and they're actually saying no.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. She was brilliant, wasn't she? I remember watching that in the documentary.
Yeah, she was an amazing lady.
It stuck with me.
Yeah.
So yes, then he's turned around, he's gone back through the sap,
filmed up, and he's ready then to film the crate.
And he talks about this in his book, How I Filmed the War. Yes, and he's quite dramatic, isn't he, and descriptive about what he saw. And he talks about the ground shaking and hanging onto his camera. Then he talks about running out of film.
Yeah. this is one of the issues.
Yeah.
You know, 16 revolutions a minute. He runs out of film.
Change it quickly.
He has to change quickly. The point where he actually runs out of film, he's filmed a mine explosion. He then pans his camera to the right and he catches the first wave of troops coming out of the frontline trench, which is known as Marlborough Street at that point. And he films the first wave moving.
Yeah.
As far as we can tell, I may be proven wrong, but
some of them are lighting up cigarettes, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But as far as we can tell, he actually manages to film the first ever footage of men being killed in action
in history.
Because you see men moving forward,
yeah,
and it's not like the classic, you know, everyone's version of the song.
Yeah,
is they all got out of their trench, they all stood up, they shouldered their rifles, yeah, and they marched towards the enemy in strict lines. These guys don't. They come out. They're bent double. They're jogging forward in single file.
They look like to me that they're walking forward in rain.
Yeah,
because like they're sort of trying.
Yeah,
to
they're ducking down.
They head off to the left.
Yeah, and as they and these are the three guys. They come forward. They turn left, and as they drop down, you see them fall.
Yeah.
Well, we looked at that, and when we did the documentary, we looked at that, and we actually recreated it.
Yeah. Yes.
And we worked out exactly why they did what they did.
Yeah.
Because as you moved forward, you then came into view at the point where they turned. You've just come into view to the crater.
Yeah.
And you will be taking fire from the crater.
So naturally, you go
natural
to the
inclination
left.
For a soldier. There's dead ground to my left. They've turned. They've gone down into what they believe is dead ground. But then on the opposite side of the road, further back up, is an area known as the Bernwerk. German machine gun positions in there, and they've got them as they've gone into what they think is dead ground.
Gosh.
Yeah.
Sitting ducks, really, weren't they?
Yeah, very much.
And then in the other part of the film, we then see them crawling back?
We do later on. It's at that point that Malins then runs out of film.
Yeah.
So he then has to change film.
Yeah.
He catches, by the time he's changed film, he then catches some of the sequence of the men moving back away from the crater after the attack has started to fail.
Yeah. But they're still falling, aren't they?
But they're still falling. They're still coming. I mean, it was described. Somebody once described it, and I've forgotten who now. It was a long time ago. But somebody once described it as like watching football fans coming back, having had their team lose a game.
Yeah, with their heads down.
Yeah. Their heads down and their so these guys, but this is a mix of Lancashire Fusiliers, 16th Battalion, the Middlesex Regiment, who are there as well, and 2nd Royal Fusiliers as well.
Yeah.
So you've got a real mix of individuals, and they're too far away for us to identify.
And then there's this photo again, where everybody's seen. This is a British soldier carrying a wounded man coming out of the trench and going across the New Beaumont Road.
Yeah.
Again, I'll put a still of this on the podcast website. And you've identified the location of that. So that's coming out of the Tenderloin Trench.
Yeah. Well, it's coming out of Marlborough, heading towards Tenderloin.
Yeah.
But again, what we've got here is that link between cinematographer, the movie man, and the still photographer.
Yeah.
Because what we get is at this point, Malins, just before he runs out of film, the last thing he captures is a rescue.
Yes.
And you see a young soldier being carried over the shoulders of two men.
Yes.
One is wearing a cardigan and one is wearing a steel helmet.
Yeah.
And they go back to the frontline trench, they lower the casualty in, and then they drop down into the trench.
With him.
And at that point, he stops filming.
Yeah.
He then relocates his camera.
Yeah.
While he's doing that, Ernest Brooks is in the trench at the side of the New Beaumont Road, opposite.
Because he's on the other side of the road, isn't he? Yeah.
And what we get is...
So he's on the Tenderloin side.
He's on the Tenderloin side. He's coming out of Marlborough. Side.
So he's coming from the
They're coming from the south.
From the southern side,
north.
Back to the north. Yeah.
And what you get is... Well, they're going to the Tenderloin, which is the advanced dressing station.
Yeah, yeah.
So what you've got is the same casualty that you've just seen being dropped into the trench with the same two men.
A few minutes later.
Now they've moved down. They're now going to cross the road.
Did he survive, do we know?
The caption says a little bit later on.
Yeah.
Because, again, this was one where we got the link to be able to complete the story using Ernest Brooks' photograph.
Yeah.
Because they cross the road, Ernest Brooks takes that iconic image, and then they disappear.
Right.
They move around the corner towards White City,
and
at that point, Geoffrey Malins has set the camera up again.
Right.
And he films them. And as he films them, the guy in the cardigan leans back against the trench and is handed a tin of corned beef.
Right.
The guy in the helmet
behind
now carries on walking behind the casualty who is now being carried by a third rescuer.
So he seems, the evidence is then, if he's eating,
so we've now
he's
got
coming
that,
away.
We've now got that link.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or the guy in the steel helmet, we know, is a guy called Walter Lidamore.
Oh, right.
And Walter Lidamore was with the heavy trench mortar batteries.
Yeah.
So was Tom Spencer.
Right.
Tom Spencer is the guy in the cardigan.
Oh.
Both of them were mortarmen. And once the attack had started, the mortars couldn't keep firing.
So the
mortarmen
became
stretcher bearers.
Yeah.
And we know this because Walter Lydimore saw himself
in the
cinema when he watched a documentary about it in 1964.
Not until then?
No, he saw himself in 1964 in the cinema in Southend.
48 years later.
Yeah, and he recognised himself and remembered being filmed.
Oh, wow, that's incredible.
Tom Spencer we identified because he is identified in, I think it was the Burnley Echo or the Burnley Express.
Yeah.
There's a photograph of him saying, a Burnley man appears in film.
He saw that.
But that appeared in 1916.
This is why this is fascinating, isn't it? When we look at the personal stories, because everyone talks about the history and what happened. These are the individual stories, aren't they, of the men?
The one individual, we've never been able to identify the casualty.
No.
The caption that goes with the film
says he dies
20 minutes later.
Yeah.
But we know it's the same casualty all the way through the sequence.
We'll never know, will we?
No. And the other guy is a guy who, again, we've not identified. There have been something like 70 claims made to the Imperial War Museum.
Oh, is this the one
where
you said you went to see the family?
Yeah, there's about 70 claims been made at the Imperial War Museum.
Because there was a watch. I've got a watch in my head.
Is that a different story? No, this particular guy, one of the claimants was a guy called Maurice Holland. And I went to interview Maurice up in, I think, Stokey.
In the documentary, you were in the National Archives going through a file.
Yeah,
going through the next scene, record. You were on your
trail. Well, what I actually did beforehand, the TV company had sent me up to Stoke to interview Maurice. And I walked in his house, lovely, lovely man.
Yeah.
And his house was like a shrine to that photograph. But his father, who he thought was the individual.
Yeah.
And there was a similarity in photographs.
Yeah.
His father was in the Royal Engineers.
Right.
But during the course of the interview, Maurice told me that his father stayed in the army until 1924, which was fantastic from our point of view.
Yeah.
Because it meant we could get his service record. He wasn't amongst those that had been destroyed. So the TV company put in a request. We got his service record.
Yeah.
And then the sequence that you mentioned about being filmed at the National Army Museum was me opening the record.
Yes. That's what I remember.
And unfortunately, the service record of Sapper Holland.
Yeah. Put him somewhere else.
Well, he doesn't actually arrive in France until 1917.
It's too late.
So, unfortunately, he can't be the guy in the
film. I remember your face when you read that. Yeah. You were gutted, weren't you?
I was absolutely gutted because I thought,
You thought you were onto it.
And I know that Maurice was...
He was gutted as well, wasn't he? Yeah. Oh, what a shame.
Yeah.
But again, it's still an interesting story. In that occasion, you disproved it.
Yeah.
And then we've got... on page 99, a stretch. You mentioned him earlier, didn't you? Walter Lydimore.
Yeah, that's about him. Yeah, I mean, when we get to 99, we're actually looking. There's a photograph of him in the 1960s there, and but he is the guy wearing the helmet in the rescue sequence.
Right.
Yeah.
And there he is.
He's a lance corporal in the Royal Garrison Artillery, so the heavy mortars.
So once again, we break off from the interview to find out a little bit more about that man, Walter Henry Lydimore. And he was born in Tilbury, Essex in 1894, and he was employed as a seaman by the Port of London Authority, and he enlisted in the Royal Garrison Artillery at Gravesend on the 27th of August 1914. He'd served with the 47th and the 461 siege batteries, and on the 21st of April 1916, he was promoted to Lance Bombardier. And then in May 1916, he was posted to the V-29 Heavy Trench Mortar Battery. And Lydimore himself said, when asked about the film, "I remember seeing the camera crew there. We were bringing wounded in from no man's land, but had to stop because of the enemy machine gun fire." And his memories back up Malin's account and confirm that the members of his unit were used to assist the Royal Army Medical Corps and the regimental stretcher bearers because they were overwhelmed by the casualties that morning. They needed help from outside of the medical units and the stretcher bearers. And that's what his job was on that day. I wonder how many men he saved.
And then I've written Captain Wells down here.
Ah, yep, Captain Wells. Captain Wells is commanding...
Smoking a cigarette, there he is.
Yeah. Well, Captain Wells, again, is one of those individuals who... And, you know, this is one of the captions where it's wounded being brought back to the tenderloin, to the dressing station.
Yeah.
And there's one of these ones, you know, it's one of these images where, you know, the archetypal image of officers are, you know, they don't... This guy actually stands up, gets out of the way so that a soldier that's been wounded in the foot can sit down.
He's showing compassion, isn't
he? He is, yeah. But Captain Wells has, you know, he's been wounded twice.
Yeah.
And but what he allows us to do is time that sequence of film.
Yeah.
Because we know that he was still with his company, despite the fact he'd been wounded twice.
On that day, twice on, wounded that day, twice on the day.
He was still with his company at 1:30 in the afternoon.
And did he go over the top then?
He
in
went
that first
over
wave?
The top. He was wounded in the head and the hand.
He wounded in the head?
Yeah, he was shrapnel wound to the side of the head and the hand. But he had to be ordered to go back for treatment. He refused to leave his company and had to be ordered back. That wasn't until 1:30 in the afternoon. And that allows us to time that piece of sequence of film.
Yes.
So we know it's shot in the early afternoon, 2:30 in the afternoon, at the Tenderloin dressing station.
And then there's a terrible story about his son, Alfred Wells.
Yes, you'll have to remind me on that.
Born in 1907, commissioned into the Berkshire Regiment, and killed on the 31st of May, 1940.
Yeah.
So having survived all that, he goes home. His son was already born by then.
Yeah.
And he's killed probably in the withdrawal to Dunkirk, 31st of May, 1940.
Yeah.
Wow. What a shame, isn't it? After he's been through all that, and then he loses his son in the Second World War.
Yeah.
And as you said, and then he's awarded the Military Cross for his bravery going back to the Somme.
Yeah. On the 1st of July.
Cecil was, not surprised, being wounded twice.
Yeah.
How did they work out who would get a Military Cross and who would get a Victoria Cross or a DSO?
It will be down to the battalion commanders putting forward recommendations.
It's just, it's not objective, is it?
No.
It's completely subjective. And there was I often think of this, there's so many men that carried out heroic acts that no one knows about because no one saw it.
Yeah. And again, one of the biggest issues for any military historian, you know, is something like, you know, the award of the Military Medal.
Yeah.
How many times have you dealt with somebody who was awarded the Military Medal?
We don't know why.
And you will never find
out
why.
No citation.
Because none of the citations survive.
No.
You know.
So before we go on, a little bit more about that brave man, Captain Wells. He was Cecil Francis Wells, born on the 21st of July, 1883 at Sotwell in Berkshire. And he was first commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Army Service Corps, but he resigned his commission in 1912. He then rejoined in 1914 when the war broke out, went to France in March 1915 and served with the 2nd Battalion of the Lancashire Fusiliers in the Ypres Salient. He was slightly wounded on the right cheek in April. He was gassed and evacuated back to England in May. He then returned to France. He joined the 1st Battalion of the Lancashire Fusiliers. And as we said earlier, on the 1st of July 1916, he received a gunshot wound to the face. And he was also hit in the hand. He commanded a battalion, so he's recovered, come back. He's commanded a battalion in December 1917, and he's wounded for a fourth time in 1918. After the war, he went back to Berkshire. Doesn't seem to have suffered any ill effects from his multiple wounds that he suffered in the Great War, because he became a noted tennis player in the 1920s. And we mentioned his son, Alfred, that died tragically in May 1940, and he's buried within, actually, the Ypres Salient, near where his father had served in the previous war. And in 1948, Cecil Wells himself commissioned a memorial window to his son Alfred in the church at Rotherfield Peppard in Berkshire, where the family lived. So let's continue with the chat with Steve once again.
Oh, come on then. This is a photo that's, again, intrigued me.
Okay.
And it's changed the way that I explain what happened after the attack on the 1st of July in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Because on page 105, we've got a very famous photo, and we think it's a roll call of the survivors of the 1st Lancashire Fusiliers lining up with the names being read out and not many people being there. We thought that was the survivors, but now we discover that's not the case.
These
are men that were in reserve?
No. You're confusing with the later scene at the Tenderloin when there's a footage of the survivors of the Seaforth Highlanders.
Ah, right. Okay.
These guys are survivors of some of the Lancashire Fusiliers.
So these guys did go over the top.
These guys went over the top.
Right.
And if you look at this image, this is actually taken at the same location as the bayonet fixing scene that we talked about earlier.
So it can't have been in the front line then?
No. This is the junction of King Street and East Hall's Way.
So it's not far. So in the distance there, Yep. Is that the ground that, heading up back towards Newfoundland
that's going
Park?
Up, no, that's going up towards White City. And Newfoundland Park is back here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But this is where Malins had filmed the bayonet fixing scene.
Oh,
he stood just behind this hut and filmed this way.
The other way around. Yeah.
The interesting thing here is you've got a company sergeant major calling the roll.
Do we know who he is then?
He's company sergeant major Greenhow.
Yeah.
Headquarters company. So he's calling the roll. You can tell from the attitude of these
That's what
men,
I thought. Look at their faces.
They've been in action.
This man nearest the camera. He's got his arms folded.
Yeah.
He's staring into space, isn't
he? Yeah. And there's another caption here where I once had somebody tell me that this guy is actually giving two fingers to the Sergeant Major. Mm. But because the image is so poor, he's not. What he's actually doing is holding a pipe.
Right, and
he's got the bowl of a pipe in his hand.
Yeah.
Well, you know.
Oh, yeah, it's that one there.
Smoking a pipe during the middle of a roll call by your company Sergeant Major.
Yeah.
He knows what they've gone through.
He's
chill with that. The interesting thing here is that the guy with the blue and white armband,
yeah,
we can pinpoint to the
So what does the blue, is that a stretch
That
area?
Denotes that he's a signaller. A runner. But we know he was in the sunken lane.
Oh, really?
At 6:30 because he's in the film.
You recognise him?
Yeah.
With the band?
Yeah, he's in the film staring at the camera. So we know that he was in the sunken lane at 6:30 in the morning.
And again, he's sitting behind the officer reading out the names, and he's got that dreadful death stare, hasn't he?
Yeah.
In his face. Yeah. You can see that. It's quite a clear photograph. Everyone would have seen this, but I will put this on the podcast page.
But then the other image on the same page is the one that you were confusing with.
Ah, right. Oh, these are the guys
in reserve. Now, somebody once told me, it's a great idea, somebody once told me that these must be the Seaforth Highlanders because they've got C written on their arm.
Right.
Okay, well, apart from the fact that Seaforth starts with an S, but...
that's one thing I'd say.
Yeah. But no, the C denotes that these are carriers.
Oh.
Okay, so these are the guys that have been carrying supplies forward.
Ah, right.
These are not the survivors of the attack.
No.
Okay. These are the 10% who have now come forward carrying fresh ammunition, fresh water, fresh food, and they're denoted by the letter C
as
the carriers.
Ah, right.
Malins, who is standing... this is the still photograph by Brooks.
Yeah.
Malins is actually getting ready because what Malins does
is
he persuades the sergeant of this group do a roll call, which means that he can then film them as the survivors.
Right.
But they're not.
No.
You know.
Right, okay. Yeah, I've got that. Okay. Let's just head down then briefly to the south. And in Chapter 8, you talk about McDowell on the 1st of July and after. And he's at Minden Post.
Yep.
And this is where we've got the prisoners of war and the casualties coming back into.
Yeah. Minden Post is situated south of the Albert Perron Road.
Something's still there, isn't it?
There's a little gully, the tunnel that you see in the film is still there.
When the men are coming through there.
Yeah, it's still there under the road. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's opposite, to the north of the road is the village of Carnoy.
Yeah.
And it's just to the
on
west.
The other side.
Just to the west of the crossroads on the main road. Down in the dip. Sheltered from view, therefore sheltered from fire, although not sheltered from fire, it's sheltered from view. But it's a situation where reinforcements are gathering, there are cyclists waiting to move forward, but it's also where one of the medical units for the southern area sets up its advanced dressing station.
The ADS.
And you've got a section for walking wounded, you've got a minor treatment location, and it's filmed for quite a considerable time.
And then on the road, just looking at this again, which is so clear, you know, it's the junction where you turn left to go down the hill towards Carnoy.
Yeah.
And you've got ambulances there with casualties being loaded onto the back of the ambulances.
I mean, to me, that's one of the more, what's the word I would use?
Graphic.
It is graphic, because what you actually see there is there's a gentleman with a Red Cross armband who is a doctor.
Mm.
And as they are loading the stretchers on, he stops one of the stretchers advancing to the back of the ambulance, looks at the casualty, looks at both the stretcher bearers, shakes his head.
He's not going to last.
And they then take him and put him to one side. He doesn't go.
What do they call it? Moribund.
He is moribund.
Yeah.
This guy has just made the decision that somebody else can be saved.
In that place.
Yeah. He's triaged.
That's what I mean by graphic.
Yeah.
Then
that's located literally just above Minden Post on the main road.
Yes, there. And then the other thing that always struck me, and I've watched it over and over again, is as the walking wounded come back, he's got prisoners of war coming back, German prisoners of war, and the soldiers are looking at these prisoners of war with these Germans with sort of intrigue, I suppose, because they suddenly realise they're the same as them.
Yeah.
And in one of them, a German stumbles and a British bloke pushes him as well, doesn't he?
He stumbles and bumps into a guy that's been wounded in the arm.
Yeah.
And the guy takes probably exception to it. Yeah, probably did do it, but he takes exception to it. But again, this is something that we forget about when we talk about the Somme and the 1st of July.
Yeah.
We are fantastic talking about the bad.
Yeah.
What we forget is that the three divisions to the south of the British line...
Yeah.
All succeed.
Yeah, because that's why they got all these POWs.
Yeah, it's where all the prisoners have come from. We've actually we capture this the ground that we are supposed to capture with complete success.
Montauban in this area.
Yeah. And you know, but we forget about that because we only ever focus on to a degree the north.
Yeah, that's right. It's funny that when we do the guided and you go out to the south, you don't see many people around there, do you?
Because nobody goes there.
They're all up at Tinker or Bermondham Out.
Let's focus on the bad bit, the tragedy.
Which again, would learn
rather than saying,
so
actually,
much.
We did quite well in some places.
Yep.
So this whole idea, and again, these guys, you know, one of the things that you get a very clear image of with the Germans is the fact that they have been under constant artillery bombardment for 7 days.
Mm.
These guys are in shock.
And then overrun.
You can physically see they are in shock.
Yeah.
They are absolutely shattered. They're exhausted. They've got no idea what's going to happen to them. And, you know, but with the Brits, there's a little bit of give or take. There's a little bit of pushing and shoving.
But generally, they're intrigued by them, aren't they?
For the most part. And then, you know, what you do get here, and again, McDowell has obviously said to somebody, you know, we need to do something here. We need to put some life into this rather than just... And he tells somebody to hand some cigarettes out.
Yeah.
And the minute he does that,
yeah,
lots of other guys come forward. And then start handing out.
And they're treating each other as humans, aren't they?
Yeah.
Right, the final bit then, wanted to talk about fake footage. Fake footage, because again, News at 10 comes on the 1st of July every year, and they show the soldiers crawling up out of this trench, which hasn't got any
which is not a
parapet
trench
or anything.
Yeah.
And then they move through the barbed wire, one bloke gets shot and he has to look back at the camera.
He does.
What's going on there?
Right. I would challenge the word fake.
Yeah.
It's not fake. It's recreated.
Okay.
Okay. And it's recreated for a reason.
Yeah.
And what's happened is that Malins, on the 3rd of July, Malins and McDowell have got together.
Yeah.
Between them, they've got about... somewhere in the region of about 18,000 feet of film.
Right.
One of them has to come back to London.
Yeah.
And has to edit. McDowell is going to stay.
Yeah.
Malins is going to come back.
Okay.
Now, one of the things that they had been asked to get was explosions.
Yeah.
Lots of big bangs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, that's quite dangerous.
Yes.
So, on the way back, Malins comes back via at a place called Flochelle, the 3rd Army Trench Mortar School.
So this is nowhere near...
On the way back. It's near Saint-Omer. So he's on his way to Calais.
It's nowhere near the front line of the Battle of the Somme.
And what happens is there is that Malins, having gone to the mortar school, thinks, this is a good idea. I can get some reasonably safe shell explosions.
Yeah.
And he does. He gets some fantastic images. I mean, some of the images that you see during the film, you actually see debris from the explosion hit the wire and move the wire.
Yeah.
So he's actually quite close, even though it's at the mortar school at St. Paul. What he also does while he's there is makes use of the mortarmen and says to them, look, you know, I need film of guys going over the top.
They've got the packs on, have they?
They've got no equipment. They've got a rifle. They've got pH gas hoods. And that's it. They've got no webbing, no bandolier.
They've
really got
trench. They've got a hole.
And what he actually does is he films a couple of times the mortarmen pretending to be infantrymen climbing out of the trench. Because that way he knows that he can then show that in the film and it gives an image that they hadn't managed to get through no fault of their own.
No. They might not have been around to tell the story had they done it for real.
So, and he uses that. So, I think the term...
I think we can let him off, don't you?
I think the term fake is probably being slightly...
It says fake in your book.
Yeah, well, it does. But it's slightly... Yeah, but that's the question. Fake. I think we can be slightly less generous and say, well, actually, I'll be more generous, shall we say. It's been reconstructed.
Well, I think that the job that the film does It's given us so much information and knowledge that it actually probably enhances the book, that little bit of reconstructed.
I mean, one of the things I found is that, I mean, when we did the book, the film hadn't been digitally remastered.
No, no.
Since we did the book, it has been.
And people can get it on DVD.
You can get it on DVD. I've got a copy that I take out on tour every time, and you know, show it on the battlefield.
Yeah,
and
it's so much easier.
I've got some of it on my iPad that I show on them. But again, one of the other things, of course, is that having had it digitally remastered, is every time I watch it, I see something different.
Yeah,
and I also found that a lot of this was used in the recent Jackson film.
Which are colourised.
They're colourised. Yeah. And again, you see so much more
when
detail.
When colourised, Well, you know what that means? Another book.
Might have to do a revisit. well, we've always talked about the sequence or the sequels, but because there are two potentials. There's in 1916, they do the Battle of the Ankh and the tanks.
Yeah.
The problem with that is it's spread over a three-month period. Multi-divisions, multi-areas, multi-locations. This was 7 days, which allowed us to do it. And the other one, of course, which I've also seen, is 1917, they made the Battle of the Ankh. The Battle of Arras.
Yes,
shall we say it's slightly less exciting than the Somme.
Right.
Yeah. Because restrictions were placed on what they could and couldn't film.
Right.
And, for example, you don't see in Arras and you don't see in the Battle of the Ankh and the tanks, you don't see British dead.
And that's
you do
perhaps,
see British dead in the Battle of the Somme.
And that's perhaps that people were so disturbed having seen the first film. Because when the people are watching this in August 16, it's still going on, isn't it?
The battle is still going on. This is being shown, and we're talking about the first use of tanks at flares. We're talking about. So while this is first being shown, Malians is back out filming the next stage.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, that's been brilliant, Steve.
Okay.
As usual, no end today, and thanks for doing that.
You're welcome.
That's time we had some lunch, really, isn't it?
Good idea.
So what I'll do then to help you follow this podcast is the photographs of the soldiers that we've talked about and the characters that we've talked about. I'll put them on the podcast page of my website, terrystours.co.uk, and I'll also put a link to the YouTube page of the documentary that Steve and his colleagues filmed in 2010. So again, you can see the process that they went through to determine who these men were. And to give you a taste of what you'll see in that documentary, here's a clip of it with Steve himself talking about the filming, and they're standing at the very position where Malins filmed the blowing of the Hawthorne mine.
So what we're basically saying, he's here, 20 past 7 in the morning, he films the crater go.
Yeah.
At some point later in the morning, he's then in the same position, he pans to his right. He's then going to pick up figures going from right to left across there. Is live footage. It's not made up. It's the real Pequot. It's people going across and they're moving forward towards the German front lines. And when you're seeing those people starting to fall, they're actually the men that are being hit.
Yes.
Whether they're being killed or wounded, but they're falling and they're being hit.
Malins was somewhere just about here on the 1st of July. And it's a culmination, really, of all the research and lots of assistance that means that I can say, that's it, we've done it. And from my point of view, it's great.
The other voice that you hear at the end there is the voice of Andy Robertshaw, one of Steve's colleagues and also the co-author of the book that he wrote, Ghosts on the Somme. So thanks very much for tuning in to these two special podcasts in two episodes, really, two parts of one episode. And I thought it would be a good idea to give the final word to Malins himself. We left him earlier on as he was filming the Middlesex and the Royal Fusiliers going across No Man's Land. And he said in the last section that we read that their ranks were becoming terribly thinned. And he went on to say still more went over and still a stream of men were making for the mine crater. Then they disappeared in the smoke. The noise was terrific. It was as if the earth were lifting bodily and crashing against some immovable object. The very heavens seemed to be falling. Thousands of things were happening at the same moment. The mine could not begin to grasp the barest margin of it. The German shells were crashing all around me. Dirt was being flung in my face, cutting it like a whipcord. My only thought was whether any of it had stuck my lens and made it dirty. For this would have spoiled my film. I gave a quick glance at it and it was all right. Fearful fighting was taking place in the German trenches. The heavy rattle of machine guns, the terrible din of exploding bombs could be heard above the pandemonium. Our men had ceased to flow from our trenches. I crept to the top of the parapet and looked towards the left of the village of Beaumont Hamel. Our guns were bursting on the other side of the village, but I could distinguish nothing else as to how things were going. And of course, now, all these years later, we know that the attacks around Beaumont Hamel were a complete disaster on that day. And that's another story. So next week, we're going to turn our attentions to 1918 and the Battle of Amiens, which was being fought 105 years ago as I speak. And we're going to look at the stories of the Battle of Amiens once again through the eyes of the soldiers that were there. And we end this week as usual by the playing of The Last Post to remember all of those men from all nations that died in and around Beaumont Hamel, not just in 1916, but in the subsequent battle that took place there in November of 1916.